might be a good idea to have some questions, because I'm probably boring you by going in a direction you don't want. Maybe for the rest of the time we can have question and answer and dialogue, because you might not want to just hear what I have to say. But there are many, many things happening that spin off from what we're talking about, Rome, but also many things on religious liberty in the United States and the civil laws that we depend on to guarantee our freedoms. Does anybody have a question? You can yell it out to start with. Go to the Holy See. I don't remember the full thing, but just dial in Holy See, S-E-E, and that'll be one of the first options. And no, I'm not recommending that you study the catechism, but it's a very accessible site. They have it divided up by Pope now, and then you go into each Pope and there's a whole swing of documents around their name. Because these documents that we're just sharing, they're all on different categories. There's apostolic letters, there's encyclicals and so on. And you can read all of them, usually in an English translation in their entirety. Like the Regensburg speech, you'll find that there. Everything's there. Plus some you might not have known existed. What amuses me is there's even a category, Secret Vatican Archives. I doubt they're the real secret archives, but there's stuff that you wouldn't normally see. It's very interesting. As long as you're prepared to wade through, you know, the stuff I was reading there, it's usually fairly heavy, long, drawn-out sentences. But that said, they say what they mean, and you can pick it up. And mind you, I don't think they're doing it with malice. It's with a sense of entitlement. This is the right of the Mother Church for all to see their authority and for them to speak to the not just all of Christendom, the term Ellen White uses for the Sunday law, but really all religions. Like I say, Father Merton that they're putting forward, you know, he was foremost in trying to integrate these different faith communities. And I think the Pope is just happy enough to be the chairman of the board, if you like, of all faith activity. Another question? Sorry?
The first pope?
Well, that's a very... I couldn't give you a year per se, but it's very contentious.
But it was bishops in Rome.
Right.
In actual Rome, it was bishops. There was no actual pope, right? Until later?
It was a little bit after Constantine. Even then, it was just the bishop of Rome. It was really as Rome started collapsing. I mean, the minute Constantine moved the capital to Constantinople... wasn't the end of Rome as a prestigious political center, but it started to wane, and they made more and more claims. But I mean, I've read it recently, but I couldn't tell you. But it's not a clear transition. It was a growing claim. Yeah.
Sometimes when I'm talking to people, I run into where they might wonder, well, what is this? This quote that I might pull from somewhere, they might say, what is this quote? Like, why, how do we know that that's what they actually say or what they actually believe? Is there a way we can know, like, what is authoritative in the Catholic Church? Like, I don't know what things are classified as authoritative. And also, with that same thinking, is with the Pope's claim to infallibility, does that mean everything he says,
no,
everything he writes? How do they... term that?
No, it's true. We can overstate it a bit too much from a Protestant perspective, because his position is very exalted, and he's the vicegerent of God and all, you know, high claims. But theoretically speaking, no, they see he's a man like anyone else. Obviously, he has the power of his office. But even on these documents that come out, a pastoral letter doesn't have that same weight that an encyclical does. An encyclical is something that has the full authority. And the term that Adventists have picked up on is very true. When he speaks ex cathedra, from the throne, using the full authority of his office and usually informed by all the bishops, that implicitly has infallibility. But I think the infallibility thing is less, I'm just saying this statement is really sort of, you know, from a divine point than to shore up the very status of the office. But they don't invoke it on every case. What they also talk a lot about in these documents, and it's arrogant to me, but I understand what they're talking about. Even when they apologize for what the Catholic Church has done, they reserve as beyond reproach the magisterium of the Church. This is its innate authority, its connection with God, you know, the keys of Peter and so on. That is close, I think, to the infallibility. Whenever the Pope speaks in accordance with the magisterium and the role that they've claimed for Rome and that God gave them, then you have that infallibility. But you'll pick it up on the website. They explain there the different authority of the different documents. But it's enough to know that the document on the environment is about as high as it comes. But some other ones are just pastoral letters. But I don't see them in practice making a great distinction between them. Anything the Pope comes out with, they at least in these writings, they accept it as very authoritative.
Lincoln, yeah. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
John Hoke.
Oh, John. My eyes are failing. I couldn't see.
Lincoln, in your opinion, how many more years before the Lord comes back? I know we can't set dates, but the rapid events that are happening in our lives and around us.
Yeah, that's just my opinion.
Right.
I mean, I've thought in the past that we wouldn't be here now. On one level, I could see it possible that we could go... you know, a lifetime or two. I think it's unlikely now, where we are now, you know, the events that are arising. We'll be lucky to get past these things now without a huge crisis. I think things are building. But I've come to the conclusion, which is consistent with what Jesus and Ellen White say a number of times, that things were meant to be wound up before now. And I've come to the conclusion that we come to these crises when it should end, or should come to the flashpoint, and we sort of cycle around and do it again. And so, what's missing? I think if I'm hesitating to say the church, because we don't snap to order, but if people with the remnant message were proclaiming adequately, you know, crying aloud and sparing not, I think it would actually curiously almost precipitate. It's a funny dynamic because Ellen White speaks to this. She says the reformers, when it happened, they thought that they'd brought the trouble on themselves, and we will think when the time of trouble comes that we've sort of caused it by speaking out of time. And in a certain way, maybe we have, but it's going to happen sooner or later, and the dynamic has to be together where you have people that are on fire for God and ready to tackle error, and then error is ready to go for them. I believe we're already at the stage. You think about it. If we really spoke out and lived out as the Bible and Adventist distinctive call us to, we'll be persecuted. I have no question. If this church really, in all of its avenues, was an end time, or as Ellen White used it, speaking about present truth rather than, you know, just running a hospital to get millions for the administrator's say, or I'm being facetious, but you know, just running institutions for the sake of it. If we were really on fire, I think we'd have trouble. We'd have bounce back, push back from society already. And maybe that's a good time for me to. Well, I left it in the car, but there's an article that was in the Washington Post a couple of days ago about how in Russia, Jehovah's Witnesses are at the moment are facing court cases and prospects of several years prison, not because they've done or haven't done anything. You know, they've been opted out of military service and other things in the past. But their very activism, the very biblical certainty has been seen as in Russia as a sign of danger. They are radicals, they are fundamentalists, they're extremists, and they're starting to ratchet up on them. And I believe that will happen here, and probably sooner rather than later. Quite some years ago, I went to a right-wing thing that I mentioned this morning as far as Jesus Christ and the Passion. But this right-wing planning session, we had a talk from a general, not a general, the general who was in charge of all the military for the U.S. And he outlined what they're planning on doing in the future. It's not that they're going to do it regardless, but their expectation is of full military operations in the U.S. We're living in a time that's very hazardous. And why would they do such a thing? When the breakdown could be precipitated partly by economic factors, but clearly the wild card that they don't know how to deal with is religious fundamentalism, radical Islam. When all of that breaks, you think non-mainline groups with an apocalyptic message like Adventists, you think we'll be left alone? It's not going to happen. So it's not good to set time. Ellen White says no time prophecy after 1844. But put it another way around. I mean, I'm surprised that there's such relative calmness about this thing in California. But if we had a Charlie Hebdo or a Paris thing in New York or Washington tomorrow, I don't think the world will stay the same here. I think we're one huge, significant incident in the U.S. away from total lockdown when all of this stuff kicks in. And that's what I was hinting at before. All of these security forces in Washington, I think they're now all being corralled. I asked the military, I said, have you ever been called out on anything like this before? Nope, never. Why would there be regular military? It's very dangerous stuff, and we need to be careful as Adventists that we don't get into a political morass, because it's no different from politics, modern day politics, as it was with the zealots in Jesus' day. It says all who take up the sword die by the sword. If we become politically involved, bad things will happen for the church, maybe quicker than they would otherwise, and more deservedly, because we're not to meddle with those things. Even if this country turns its back, as it will, on the whole Constitution at some point, we're not to turn against this country. We only defy it, if there's such a word to be used, when it asks us to do something against our faith. And Americans are not geared up to think that way, but it just happens that we've had a good system here. But if you lived under Saddam Hussein when he was alive in Iraq, a Christian should have been behaving the same way, not bothering the state and living their life until it bumped up against a claim, counterclaim by the state. Christians in the communist countries had no cause to be blowing themselves up or bombing Communist Party headquarters. They had to live exemplary Christian lives within it. And when this country truly shows that it's on the turn, we still live harmless Christian lives. But don't be deceived. Incredible things are coming. I'm being recorded, so I don't want to say. But there's plenty of evidences. But even the people that may be planning, not maliciously, they wouldn't know. We're in a sequence of cause and effect, but we don't know the speed. Some things speed it up more, some things slow it down. But we're clearly, inexorably, moving to the twilight of liberal democracy. We're clearly moving toward the end of the plenty for those that have been living off the third world and the modern world with communications and the globalist trade. It can't be sustained. And I've said this before, it's a better way to conclude. You and I can't know when the world will end or when the time of trouble starts. But I can stake my life on one thing. The world that you know is about to pass away. This is a time of revolution. You've seen the entire Middle East go up in smoke, and it didn't turn out well. You know, naive people thought that it was the beginning of liberal democracy. Latin America is in the middle of one, in case you haven't been reading the media. There's two or three countries already overturning the old order. Ellen White says, just before the return of Christ, scenes throughout the whole world will be like those of the French Revolution. And that's what we're seeing. And computerization and globalization, all of these factors that we see day by day, and we know that they're big, but they're much bigger than you imagine. They're changing the world beneath your feet. And every now and again, like the collapse of 2009, something just stair-steps in the direction it's been going very rapidly. So it can appear as a momentary shift, but the shift is moving on us every day very rapidly. And the old norms are going. Just think how long ago gay marriage was just sort of a wacko idea from a few liberals and within the church, not at all. But now, we're at the level even the church is discussing whether we'll accept members that are gays or pastors and so on. The moral shift is radical, and it's happened in just a couple of years. And we'll get to the point where the most unthinkable things of a few generations or a few years ago are going to be taken for granted. Yeah, go ahead.
Have you noticed in your legal stuff anything that the infiltration of Rome's Jesuits into...
Well, I haven't noticed it. This is an interesting question.
Like Seventh-day Adventists.
I'm on record, but I'll say it anyhow because he and I debated. Way before I was editor of Liberty, Cliff sort of got my go-to-bit once, Cliff Goldstein. He ran an article column in the Review, and he offered $1,000 for anybody that would identify a Jesuit in the Adventist Church. And went and talked to him, and I said, you know, how foolish. I said, of course there's Jesuits in the Adventist Church. The real question is whether we should be looking for them, and of course we wouldn't. The McCarthy era in the U.S. showed very plainly that that's counterproductive to look for Reds under every bed or Jesuits in every seminary. I mean, no. I mean, that we should never do that. But to maintain that we haven't had Jesuits in the Adventist Church is not to understand Jesuits. They would have been negligent if they hadn't at some point penetrated Adventism, which we're not a huge church, but we're one of the few that's hewing to the old-style interpretations of the Reformation. It's precisely the reason that the Jesuit order was established. So, yeah, of course. But don't worry about it. There's more enemies around and more doubters and dissemblers than just the Jesuits. I wouldn't worry about it. But you just should accept it as a given. I keep thinking of things that I don't want to be recorded.
Well, that's one of my questions. If there is anything that you would say to us if you weren't recorded, or if the recording could be turned off, if there was anything that you would say
to
us.
Well, they might, but that's academic.
Right. No, I mean, they could. They can turn it off. It's just that easy.
Some of it's not good for all of us to say. Some of it's not good for me personally to say. I'll get into trouble.
Well, that's not to my question, but I will address that. You talk about how you were surprised at the easy acceptance of the Pope's message and how the sunburst was waved in front of the Pope and people just didn't get it. Well, one of the things in this country is critical thinking is going out the window. It's not being taught in school. People aren't really taught to critically think. And then the concentration within the media outlets, the average citizen can't turn on the TV and really get the scoop of what's going on. So you either have to spend the time on the internet and, you know, ferreting through which site is true and what's not is very difficult.
Tricky. Yeah.
So the work that you do is important because, you know, otherwise people are not really clear on what actually is happening.
And even if they read what we're putting in Liberty, they still need to critically examine it, not take it just because we say it.
Right. Well, but the quality of that information...
I mean, Americans are as intelligent as anyone else, but the system here has conspired to restrict real information from Americans,
correct,
more than most countries.
Correct.
I know, you know, I'm from Australia originally, and when I go back there, they talk that way. When I go to Europe, they talk that way. And you look at the news in most other countries, and they get aspects of stuff you never get here.
Correct.
Even when you think there's a lot of news,
it's
on one level and it's just repetitive. There's not much substance to it. It's not always manipulative news, but a lot of it is choreographed by powers behind the scenes that have influenced. You know, the reporters, I don't think the reporters are part of some conspiracy to just give the party line, but they're micromanaged like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
Like, just think of George Bush. If he didn't like the question they asked him in the White House briefings, they were off. So you think a reporter's going to ask him uncomfortable questions? Certainly not. So they become very compliant. Especially in Gulf War II and other wars like that, where they embed the reporters with the military agencies, you know, they're not going to say anything different than what they're told. So we get a very one-dimensional thing. And what's missing, I think, since we're the U.S. is the superpower, certain things are just, it's taken as granted that whatever we do is right. Where I know in other countries, they look at the situation critically. They may not always get it right, but they analyze it just from a distant perspective. And they might say, discuss what's America in for this time, what's Russia in. But it's certain that what we're getting, and I'm getting into a political statement, but what we're seeing in the media about Russia's motives is just nonsense.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they're always right, but we just have it totally wrong.
Well, my real question was, we've talked a lot about politics and political as it relates to the Pope and Roman Catholicism, but just switching to the economic component of it, and we've been reading more about China's...
Which the Bible speaks of. That's the big event right at the very end of time. This global coalition that is upholding false worship is a business entity. And when it collapses, the merchants of the world weep and wail because in that short period of time it's gone.
So I just was wondering what China is in trying to become a reserve currency and trying to become more prominent as a world power, how that all fits into this whole...
Well, I could discuss it. All that is relevant to here is we need to... John was asking about how long this goes. We're in a fool's paradise. There is no real substance to the monetary situation that we're existing on. It's played out. It's a shell game. The U.S. dollar, I mean, I want it to continue personally, but the U.S. dollar is totally divorced from reality now. We're a massive debtor nation, right? And normally we would be like Greece. Why is it continuing? It's because, and you referred to it, after World War II, the victor, the U.S. and its allies, sat down together and they outlined an economic order for the world, and the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. So everyone has a vested interest in seeing that we continue to exist. But we printed $1.2 trillion of made-up money last year. Didn't even get a loan or a promissory note. It's just a couple of keystrokes. I mean, normally that's the end of you, but we're getting away with it because we're still the reserve currency. But there's been signs of trouble, and China and Europe and Russia have been getting together to try to replace the dollar with a basket of U.S. currencies. That will be trouble for us because it means we have to pay our debts. And worse, Saddam Hussein, which I believe is the reason we took him down, specified that his dollars, his oil for a food program, that it had to be paid in euros. And Gaddafi, just before he was killed, made the same claim. He was trying to put up an African currency where oil was bought and sold on non-dollar margin. To understand the U.S., I had a big argument with one of my religious liberty associates at the GC on this, because like most everyone else, he was always comparing the U.S. to Rome. We had nothing to do with Rome. The historical model of understanding the United States is Venice. We are a trading country. This is a trading empire. And Venice played an incredibly manipulative role in world events in their age. They had a bit of an army of their own, but their whole goal was to force someone to trade with them on their good terms. That's what we're after. The U.S. doesn't have a great interest in or need to overpower and occupy another country. We want to force them to trade with us on our terms. That's why we sent Commander Perry to Japan and at gunpoint forced them to open to the West. That's what we're after in most countries. And it's not a bad thing. in an absolute sense, but you need to understand it to understand how the U.S. operates. And it's also what the Bible talks about. It's both a moral issue on false worship and economic dominance, is what it's talking about in Daniel and Revelation. But once you understand that, I hope I've given you a little opening. I studied history. I love history. That's the key to understanding the U.S. Americans are as good a people as anywhere else. The structure of government is not even necessarily bad, but it's an economic system of economic dominance based on trade. Without that, it's nothing. And that is being threatened on all fronts. And the Pope is threatening it. And I don't know, none of us can ever know, why Boehner left almost the next day. But I think that might be why it was, because even though the Pope was clearly speaking from power in the speech, it was basically an in-your-face to capitalism. It was not a good talk for Republicans, certainly. So that's the pressure that we're facing. And again, what does the Bible say? All the weak shall say, I'm strong. All the little countries rising up. The other thing that the Pope is pushing for is forgiving third world debts. These are huge issues. They're not just, you know, a nice moral idea. These are things that will change the world as it exists.
Yes, Brother Steed. I'd just like to recognize a statement of appreciation for something that you said that many people might not realize. In Seventh-day Adventism, there's so much of this is the issue and that's an issue. And people always want to know the real dirty secrets of stuff. And I speak too, so I understand this, that there are certain things that we should not say on tape. So I appreciate that you didn't share some information, because the thing that we don't realize is these messages are going out to all kinds of people.
Yeah.
And all these type of people see these issues, and then they see a church and say, well, I don't want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
So there we have to have some discernment as speakers that there are certain things that we don't say.
Well, thank you. And I don't know that I always have the right discernment, but I'm getting more and more cautious. And even the simplest things are misused. You have no idea some of the letters we get. People run with the silliest things. Yeah, one more and then we'll finish.
Well, I have two questions. And one is, how would you analyze Ben Carson's...
For the record, I can't comment on it. There's been a decision made at our headquarters for North America that only the communications or the officers on occasion will speak to that. I don't necessarily agree, but they have their reasons, and it's safe. I'll say that.
The other question I have, and that is, the Pope, of course, is a Jesuit.
Sorry? Oh, the Pope
is a Jesuit.
That's right.
And is he responsible to his general? I understand through history, all the Jesuits are responsible to their general. What would you say to that?
Well, I'm sure he works in consultation with them.
Or is he a superior to his own general, you know, of the organization?
I'm sure he's superior to him, but he certainly works with the Jesuits. But that in itself is very telling. An order that has come under some suspicion, even in recent years by Rome, is now given a pope. They've put the most battle-hardened order in charge. I mean, that's sort of like putting, isn't it, Carl Icahn or someone in charge of the company? He's going to sort it out. But I've often told the story, and people have forgotten. The Jesuit order overstated themselves in the 70s when they were involved I'm trying to remember what the term was, liberation theology. And there was a very interesting incident that I've spoken of many times when I've traveled around, but I'll never forget it. John Paul II, early on in his pontificate, went to Nicaragua, and there were two Catholic priests in the military junta. And I remember watching on TV as he arrived, and one was a Mary Knoll priest, who, through some alchemy of politics I don't understand, when I next saw him, he'd turned up as the chairman, for want of a better title, of the General Assembly of the UN. But there was a Mary Knoll priest, and then the first priest was a Jesuit. And as the Pope gets off the plane, the Jesuit priest goes down on his knees and reaches out to grab the ring, and the Pope whipped it back from him and just because the mic wasn't on, but he wagged his finger at him and told him off. What I found out a few years ago, but it's disappeared from YouTube, that same visit, the Pope spoke to a very large outdoor audience of young people, and he obviously didn't say what they liked, and so they started throwing things at him, and you've never seen this video, and he was shaking his fist at them and screaming abuse, and then he stormed off. And what I read at the time is he went back to Rome, just fit to be tied about the Jesuits, threatening to dissolve the order. He mandated that they need to drop liberation theology, and he made the comment, he says, from now on we're going to be on the side of power. And he threatened to dissolve the order, and he replaced you used the title, I've forgotten, the general, of the order. He replaced him with someone sympathetic to him, and he made every Jesuit swear a personal oath of loyalty to the papacy, which should have, was how they started off, but he started them from scratch. So this cardinal, as a Jesuit, is not the old-style Jesuit, you know, relatively old. He's the new sorted-out guys that are on the straight and narrow. So they had an internal revolution where they took on the Jesuits and brought them into line to serve the papacy. And you know, that's what it is. But don't go look. Well, you can go looking, but tell me if you find that video. I saw it, and then I went back recently, and I can't dig it up. And many things on YouTube are taken off for copyright reasons, and others are taken off at the request of different entities. So they obviously don't like that video. And, you know, all human beings lose it from time to time. It doesn't mean, that in itself doesn't mean that John Paul was the Antichrist. But it was a very contradictory message from what we were conditioned to expect from him. He just totally lost it and then directed his ire against the Jesuits. Was that, you said you had two parts. Well, thank you for indulging me. And just remember that Liberty Magazine is your church paper for religious liberty. It doesn't usually get into this sort of stuff. I mean, on the Pope we will. But a lot of the speculation about where things are heading, I mean, that's not really the role of liberty. Its role is to project the biblical, the historic, the constitutional, and, you know, a rationale for religious freedom for all people. And, you know, we can attack Roman Catholics in liberty, but not from a doctrinal point of view. We have to deal with it here on a matter of church-state separation. And on that, they're culpable. But, you know, everyone has a right under the principle of religious liberty to believe whatever they believe. Doesn't mean they are right, but before God and before the Constitution, we have to allow them to be wrong. It's an interesting principle that a lot of people don't understand. The only distinction that we'd never discussed, but I'll just give it to you for a passing thought. I think it's reasonable to allow people to make their own choice. But when we're involved in a situation where we're facilitating someone else's choice, I think there's a bit of a distinction between allowing them to be right and facilitating what the Bible calls witchcraft. You know, that's culpable. We're not. And I think where that might kick in is when you're dealing with the whole gay agenda, for want of a better term. I'm not talking about gays, but I mean there's a whole anti-God agenda there. I'm not sure we're to make it easy for people to curse at God, but we are to stand back and let people make good and bad choices, because that's their right, both as citizens and primarily as creatures of a creator God. But you and I individually, when we're talking about our faith, we have every obligation to speak of God and his requirements and to say that something's wrong. We should be able to speak to the moral decline in the country without damning every individual, because some of those people may be deceived, they may be debauched by their behavior, they can't see right from wrong. And, you know, and they're all creatures of God. But that shouldn't mean that we have a sort of a false charity where we accept them and what they do all as one package. It's a tricky game, but our church, I believe, is in grave danger of accepting some of these wrong concepts and sort of thinking that it's charity. We've got to have strong moral absolutes, even in a time of great immorality. Well, thank you very much, and God bless you.
Thank you, Brother Steed. Thank you for blessing us today. How many of you have been blessed? Can you say amen? Amen. We'd like to close our time together with a word of prayer. Can I ask you to bow your heads as we ask for God's blessing? Father in heaven, Lord, there's no better time, no more appropriate time to come together and discuss the things that are happening, Lord, than on your Sabbath day. Because in the final analysis, no matter what happens, Lord, all things are in your hands. We rest and we put our faith in you, and that's the call of the Sabbath, is to place our rest and our trust in you. So we thank you for the blessings that you've shared with us through Brother Steed and his insights. Father, we ask you to give us a safe travel home to wherever that may be for each of us. We ask your blessing on us the rest of this Sabbath, and we look forward to serving you and pray that you use us and use this church to carry your message to the world. These things we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.